a runaway train today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump declares the opioid crisis a public health emergency. This expert likens it to a runaway train fueled by the overprescription of painkillers.
We let this train accelerate and accelerate, and then all of a sudden people realized that this train was going in the wrong direction at way too high a speed.
We'll hear what other countries do to control the problem. Plus, writer Lenora Chu moved from the U.S. to China, and when it came time to enroll her 3-year-old in kindergarten there, she encountered a very different teaching philosophy.
This idea of authoritarianism in the classroom was very interesting to me, and also a little bit troubling.
Those stories ahead today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thank you for joining us. Every day, it seems, we hear about people who are overdosing in our cities, often right in our neighborhoods. Today, President Trump declared the opioid epidemic a national emergency.
Families, communities, and citizens across our country are currently dealing with the worst drug crisis in American history.
But the president said it's not just an American problem.
The fact is, this is a worldwide problem. This crisis of drug use, addiction, and overdose deaths in many years, it's just been so long in the making. Addressing it will require all of our effort, and it will require us to confront the crisis in all of its very real complexity.
But here's the thing. The U.S. has just 4% of the world's population, but it consumes 30% of the world's opioid supply, and Canada follows closely behind. So why is the problem so much worse here in North America than in other parts of the world? To get some answers, we turn to Dr. Benedict Fisher. He's the chair in addiction psychiatry at the University of Toronto. A couple of years ago, Fisher and his team looked at differences in the way opioids are advertised, sold, and prescribed in North America, and then did a global comparison.
First of all, in North America, we're societies where we treat ailments primarily through drugs for almost everything, you know, from diabetes to heart problems to erectile dysfunction, are the solutions a drug. And our medical systems, our medical cultures are primed, systemically conditioned into prescribing drugs, typically at higher levels than most other countries for almost everything. So we just jump to the prescription pad way too quickly for too many people and provide them with these drugs at too long a time. And one of the factors that's driving that, of course, also is the way our medical systems are designed as basically, you know, they're basically industrial businesses in a way. And for every patient that walks into a physician's office with pain, the most cost-effective thing for the medical system, of course, is, you know, rather than doing an extensive diagnosis and looking at potential somatic or psychological symptoms and experimenting with different things, is just to grab the prescription pad and write a script for something that will, for a while, provide some symptom relief, but then at the end of the day, for many people, cause more long-term problems than solutions.
So European countries have very different public health systems than we do in the U.S. I'm curious to know, how much does that change the overprescription factor when you kind of look at Europe?
It does very much because the prescribing and the way these drugs are handled and approached in the medical systems in terms of prescribing is typically regulated much more tightly. In many countries, you only have certain physicians allowed to prescribe them, or the regulated dosing or length of prescriptions are different. A lot of the potent opioids are only used in hospital settings. So there are many different regulatory and other practical, but also cultural things. You know, in Europe, physicians often think a lot more, you know, what are really sort of the causes behind certain symptoms, and are there things other than drugs we can apply here?
How much of a factor is the aggressive marketing by pharmaceutical companies? Like, do you find big pharma commercials in Europe the way we do here?
It's a huge factor, and definitely for opioids was. You're asking me about advertising in Europe. It doesn't exist. There are only
Why not?
Countries, because it's illegal. the decision makers and regulators have decided that that's not a desirable good thing, not in the interest of the health of the population. And so there are only two countries in the world where direct-to-consumer advertising is allowed, and it's the United States and New Zealand.
Dr. Fisher, what is your advice for slowing down this crisis in North America, reversing these unnecessary deaths?
Well, a few things have begun, but we sort of maneuvered ourselves in a double jeopardy thing because we let this train accelerate and accelerate in terms of the over-prescribing and all the related harms. And then all of a sudden people realized that this train was going in the wrong direction at way too high a speed. And people have been trying to stop that train. The problem is that with those existing conditions, a lot of people using these drugs and habituated into these drugs and medical supplies drying up, that these restrictions have been bringing in the very undesirable and often highly toxic supplies of illicit opioids. So in the U.S., heroin use has been going up as a consequence of restricting prescription opioids. The illicit fentanyls and fentanyl analogs have been coming in, have been produced. So this is a real challenge. We're really at a point where we're not exactly sure what is it better right now to further restrict aggressively medical opioid supplies, or leave them at a certain point until we can deal with all the people, you know, that are dependent on them, that are using them at risk and are at risk of overdose.
Dr. Benedict Fisher, the chair in addiction psychiatry at the University of Toronto, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Very good talking to you.
Here's another domestic story that also crosses borders. I'm talking about the teenager at the center of a fight in Texas over abortion rights. She's an undocumented immigrant who is only known as Jane Doe in court filings. The Trump administration had tried to block her from leaving the detention center she's being held in. That's because she wanted to have an abortion. And as a minor, she needed her parents' permission. But Jane Doe had crossed the border on her own, so it became an issue for the court to decide. On Tuesday, an appeals court ruled that she could have the procedure, and yesterday morning she got the abortion. Jasmine Garz is with our Across Women's Lives desk. Jasmine was reporting last month from the clinic where Jane Doe went to terminate her pregnancy. So tell us, first of all, about the case of Jane Doe. Remind us what her story is of coming to Texas.
Sure. So we do know that she's Central American. She's 17 years old, and she was detained while crossing the border. And she's being held at a detention facility in Brownsville, Texas. And when she was detained, she found out she was pregnant and asked for an abortion. I mean, this whole Jane Doe story is a hot potato. I mean, it really brings the intersection of immigration policy and reproductive rights policy. It's kind of a nightmare story. And meanwhile, the clock was ticking. She was 15 weeks pregnant, and Texas only allows abortions up to 20 weeks.
Really complicated case. I mean, many abortion clinics have shut down in Texas in recent years. And I'm just wondering, as this all unfolded, was it known where Jane Doe would be terminating her pregnancy if she were allowed to do so?
Yes, a large number of Texas clinics have indeed closed down. You know, Jane Doe is detained in Brownsville, Texas, right by the border. And in that whole region, there is only one clinic nearby that provides abortions, which is about an hour away. And this clinic is the only clinic in the Rio Grande Valley. I mean, the next clinic you would have to go to would be in San Antonio. And, you know, heading south, it's the only clinic up until Mexico City. So I called up a group of volunteers who I met last month in Texas, in McAllen, when I was reporting on that very clinic. And they told me that, indeed, she was at the clinic yesterday morning. And this whole time, they were kind of bracing for the protesters, the media. One volunteer, her name is Mimi Martinez, said she felt very frustrated at the whole back and forth, and they were waiting and waiting to see if this young woman would be allowed out of the detention facility and into the clinic.
Even though I may not even approve of you being here, and I may not approve of you having a child within the United States, I feel like you need to keep this child. Yet, I'm not going to provide any services, and I'm going to want to actually probably send you back to your home country where you're obviously running from something. Otherwise, why would you be here?
And Marco, what she's obviously referring to is what she sees as a very hypocritical stance. A lot of the anti-abortion people who were very vocally opposed to this young woman getting an abortion also take the stance against immigration.
Who was it exactly that was stopping Jane Doe from getting an abortion?
You know, in March of this year, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is also known as ORR, announced that federally funded shelters are barred from taking any action that facilitates abortion for unaccompanied minors without the direction or approval of Director Scott Lloyd, who has an anti-abortion stance. It's quite public. And Jane Doe herself said that she was forced to obtain counseling from a religiously affiliated crisis pregnancy center, and she was forced to look at the sonogram.
So Jane Doe did terminate her pregnancy yesterday. What happened?
The volunteers told me that she came in very early. There weren't protesters, and she left holding on to one of her chaperone's arms. It is a procedure that requires anesthesia, so patients come out woozy. You know, Marco, this is a case that has divided not just Texas, but the entire country. For the pro-choice movement, the fact that Jane Doe was able to go there is a victory. And for the pro-life sector, it's a huge blow. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton expressed his profound disappointment at the court's decision to allow Jane Doe to have an abortion. He said, quote, "Today's loss of innocent human life is tragic, and it may have been avoidable."
Jasmine Garr is with our Across Women's Lives desk. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. A pleasure.
There's time for one more quick bit of news before the break. Thailand is in the midst of 3 days of mourning for King Bhumibol Adulyadet. Yesterday, a huge day-long funeral procession made its way through the capital, Bangkok. Hundreds of thousands of mourners dressed all in black were there to say their final goodbyes. The king was cremated in an extravagant ceremony a full year after his death. My BBC colleague Jonathan Head was in the crowd.
The actual urn, a beautifully carved and gilded sandalwood container, is being carried very slowly in an enormous 14-ton carriage that has been pulled by 222 spectacularly uniformed soldiers. I can see the smoke from the guns now, just before in front of the pavilion. And it's arriving at the pavilion now, but it is a very slow procession. There's another stage in today's proceedings where it's transferred to a gun carriage and then taken anti-clockwise 3 times around the pavilion before the urn is taken up into the crematorium itself.
King Bhumibol Adulyadet ruled for 70 years before his death last year at the age of 88. Under his rule, Thailand became wealthier, but the monarchy's power also grew. Again, Jonathan Head.
When he came to the throne, the monarchy had really lost a great deal of its status and power. It was much diminished. He helped to rebuild it in partnership with the army, it must be said, and a lot of his reign was under military governments and in partnership with allies like the United States. He was a great Cold War ally. He's credited with being a moderating influence, with bringing factions together, with keeping a kind of deal whereby the country progressed. It grew, it developed, and people accepted that. Others criticize him for being too conservative and for not allowing free criticism of the monarchy, and he certainly didn't challenge the laws.
But the late king is revered in Thailand. One mourner said, "The king did so much for us, his people. I've walked so far to be here that my toenails have fallen off." And the mourners aren't going anywhere yet. Ceremonies for the late king will continue today and tomorrow. Just ahead on the show, Portland, Oregon wrestles with racism. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. For the past 2 days, reporter Rupa Shenoy has been sharing stories from Portland, Oregon. It's a city known for being almost ridiculously liberal. Just watch an episode of the TV show Portlandia.
Do you remember the 90s?
Yeah.
You know, people were talking about getting piercings and getting tribal tattoos.
Yeah.
And people were singing about saving the planet and forming bands.
Yeah.
There's a place where that idea still exists as a reality, and I've been there.
Where is it?
Portland.
Oregon?
Yeah. Dream of the
90s is alive. But 75% of Portland is white, and that's more than any other big city in America. So where does that leave people of color asking the city to change after a shocking hate crime? That's a question Rupa looks at today.
On his desk in his office at the Portland Police Union, there's a picture of Daryl Turner shaking hands with Barack Obama. It's from back when Obama was an Illinois senator.
So I went and took a picture with him, and he said, "Hey, I really respect law enforcement and what you guys do." I says, "Hey, we got some changes we got to make, but yeah."
Turner played football at the University of Washington and joined Portland's gang task force in the 1990s. Now he's the first black president of the union. And when the mayor put out a job ad for a new police chief and said that person should be able to address Portland's history of legally enforced systemic racism, Turner called him out. He said the mayor should have put it in a more positive way.
You have to remember the past, but you also don't dwell on it. You move to the future, although we have learned lessons from the past.
Do you think we've acknowledged what happened in the past?
I think there's always going to be some resistance to totally acknowledge, but that will be from people who don't want to be part of the movement to move forward.
The question of how the movement goes forward, it hangs in the air everywhere in Portland. On the one hand, you have people so radicalized, they're thinking about violent tactics. On the other hand, there are people who've been fighting in the trenches for years, including two elder statesmen of local immigrant communities.
My full name is Ronald Latangsayan Catalani. People call me Polo for short. My 8-to-5 job is as the city of Portland's immigrant integration policy guy.
My name is Wajdi Said. I'm the current president of the Muslim Education Trust.
Said's from Yemen. He came here as a college student, and after the murders on the light rail, he helped raise thousands of dollars for the victims. Polo Catalani's family was expelled from Indonesia for being mestizo. Now he's a lawyer, and he's very open about how he's gone around regular channels in order to get work done fast in Portland's immigrant communities.
Remember, we're from countries where government has never been there for us. We go the other way when we see them.
So for years, to get things done, Catalani and Said have partnered with community elders, civic activists, and city workers to finish specific projects like community gardens, mobile playgrounds, or just to get a street light installed.
This is doing it instead of talking about it.
Reality is that we have to be positive. We cannot afford to be negative.
Yes.
Seriously.
Recently, they've connected undocumented mothers with individual police officers they can trust not to share their information with federal authorities.
And we tell them, don't do 911. You call an officer who you've talked to, who you've spent time with.
Catalani and Said say this is how they've made progress, albeit person by person and slow. That seemed to be enough until the presidential election and until two men were murdered on the Portland light rail protecting two black women. For people who don't feel safe, who feel targeted, it's tough to live in a city people think of as ultra-liberal because that doesn't match the reality they're experiencing.
In Oregon, everybody will say the right things, but yet they actually either don't do the wrong things or opposite things, or they don't do a lot.
Casey Jama is from Somalia, and he runs the nonprofit organizing group Unite Oregon. We're sitting outside a mall. He tells me people have protested outside Unite Oregon's offices. Their windows have been covered in anti-Islam pamphlets. At one of their events a few months ago, some men drove by waving replica guns. Jama's tried to find out what happened to those guys, if they were prosecuted. He says he hasn't gotten an answer. Other Muslims have told him about being harassed while driving.
And then when they called the police was treating the issue as some sort of a road rage issue, and I give them the information. I told them what happened. I never heard back from them.
Later, Jama had this moment of clarity that summed up the situation for him. It was a few weeks after the murders on the light rail, and groups Jama calls white supremacists were rallying in a downtown park. Jama was across the street, speaking in front of the doors to City Hall.
As I was speaking at the podium, picture came to my mind. I was like, oh my goodness. Because what I saw was the law enforcement holding their clubs facing us. And the white supremacists were in their backs. So I ask a question for myself, who are they protecting and who do they see as the problem?
So Jama says he's doing everything he can to change things fast. He's running for state senate. To be fair, Portland police spokesman Sergeant Chris Burley says police want everyone to feel like they're heard. He points to the Bureau's many advisory committees for marginalized groups and to the new Portland police chief who started her job earlier this month. She's the first African-American woman to lead the Bureau.
You know, we must be aware of the perception that people have about the legitimacy of the police bureau. The police bureau is learning how we are perceived. And we want to be an agency that is trusted. And if it's something that may not fit our definition of a crime, we want people to know that we do have compassion and we do have sorrow for those types of situations.
Those reassurances aren't enough for Gregory McCovey, a 24-year-old political consultant about to finish his law degree. He grew up black in Portland and now leads one of the city's largest protest groups, PDX Resistance, which is frequently taken to the streets in demonstrations that sometimes turn violent.
I have to say and do say that I don't condone violence against people or property, but I think that it's a shame that we have a lot of people in Portland that maybe are more upset about broken windows than the people that are forced to sleep outside next to the shattered glass. There does come points in human history where violence is needed to stop further violence.
McCovey argues current change isn't coming fast enough, especially now when the question of safety is real and urgent for people of color, including me, I guess. Because when Rani Ayoub, the outreach person for the Muslim Educational Trust, was showing me around, walking me through their classrooms, the pool, and the gym-like space that converts into a prayer area, I asked,
"Do you mind if I ask about security, how you keep the kids safe?"
"Sure, no worries. We have our main entrance is always locked. Our doors are always locked, and only people who are buzzed in can enter the center, if that makes sense. How did you get in?"
"I just walked in."
"Oh, okay. Was it open?"
"Yeah."
"Okay. Dismissal time is kind of open."
I also asked Polo Catalani, the city's immigrant integration policy guy, and Wajdi Saeed, the Muslim Educational Trust executive director.
"You're aware of this millennial generation that seems to be very impatient for change."
"Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We're aware of them, and they're aware of us."
"They also don't seem to be able to understand, of course they cannot, that plateau from which they are able to be this way is because we really suffered."
In a few minutes, though, Catalani reconsidered.
"About those millennials, I'm so proud of them because they've raised the level of expectation from our communities. Our level of expectation from white folks is fairly low because we've never expected anything. So, okay, never mind, I'll fix that myself. You guys, you give me a headache and a stomach ache and a backache, I will just get with my people and we'll fix this, never mind you. But now each next generation is expecting Americans to give more, to do more, to be more."
And Catalani says, for this, they are grateful. For the World, Rupa Shenoy, Portland.
News headlines are up next. You're with the World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, what pushed a 30-year-old former banker to leave Britain and join the fight against ISIS in Syria?
"I couldn't stand there and watch the Islamic State run all over the Middle East, sending it back to the Dark Ages. I had to go and offer my solidarity and do my part in defeating the Islamic State."
Maser Gifford's story, that's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Just a few years ago, Maser Gifford was leading a pretty cushy life in London. He had a lucrative job as a currency trader, a steady girlfriend, and parents he got along well with. But Maser Gifford, that's a pseudonym he uses to protect his identity, he couldn't stop watching the news. Images of gruesome beheadings and atrocities perpetrated by the Islamic State stuck in his mind. So Gifford took a step some might consider foolhardy.
"I don't have a death wish. I have a very loving family. I care passionately about Britain and my community in the UK and just getting on with life. But at the same time, as an internationalist, I couldn't just sit by and watch the Islamic State do what it was doing."
So Gifford traveled to Syria and joined the Kurdish rebels fighting ISIS. He's been fighting for years now, most recently in the battle for Raqqa. I caught up with Gifford today. He was in northern Syria near the border with Iraq. He told me about a skirmish a few weeks ago when the Kurdish unit he was leading got into trouble.
"It was pitch black. It was 3 o'clock in the morning, and we were ambushed by the Islamic State with a heavy machine gun. Two of my comrades were hit. One died immediately on the scene. I was hit myself, in fact, hit my body armor, and I threw myself backwards, fell over, crawled out of the road. And then I realized that two of my guys were lying in the road. We ran out. We picked up one, a Demhart, who was the only one who was alive. And we brought him in. And I begged the team leader to evacuate him out. But by this time, we were already surrounded. And after an hour, hour and a half, Demhart's condition worsened while I was holding his hand and while I had his head in my lap. And he died."
Couldn't the Americans or the Brits have come to your rescue, helped out somehow?
"Well, actually, the Americans and Brits did. In terms of the airstrikes that came the next day, we were the ones in the city taking the ground, taking the buildings, fighting in the stairwells, fighting in the cellars, whereas the Americans and Brits were mostly the ones flying the drones. They were calling in the airstrikes. They were hitting them with mortars. There were medics as well. The next day, we were completely surrounded and cut off. We had no food, no water, and our ammunition wasn't great, although we still had plenty by the time we were finally liberated. But that was a huge concern of ours. And the Americans blitzed the area directly opposite us and allowed other units to come up in support of us. And 24 hours later, we got out. It could have been a lot worse for us.
Yeah, I mean, you volunteers were there kind of doing the dirty work.
Yeah, well, it's totally true. I mean, we're the ones who are on the front line. We're the ones who are fighting directly with the people of Syria, people who are taking their country back. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I never campaigned for American or British troops to be directly involved in the fighting because there's plenty of fighters on the front line. What I've always campaigned for is much more political and military support. Being there as internationalists was fantastic, and showing our solidarity was very much sort of accepted by the locals. But we were very much symbolic as well, trying to get that extra support wherever we could get it.
Interesting to hear you call yourself an internationalist. I mean, how did you end up in Syria? Like, what prompted the move?
I had a very traditional upbringing, and actually also very closeted as well. I was very much a conservative. My internationalism didn't grow until I went to university. Graduating in one of the worst recessions since the 1920s, meant that I sort of fell into the city almost. I wanted to work for a charity. I wanted to get out and explore the world a little bit more. But I almost fell into the city, and discovering what was going on in Syria really was like discovering something that I'd almost lost while I was at university, a sense of justice, a sense of wanting to change things.
And at the time when you said, I'm going to Syria, did you think, well, this probably violates Britain's Terrorism Act. How am I ever going to be able to get back home?
Well, actually, no. One of the things that actually swung me and made me very determined to go was actually seeing a conversation that between a journalist and the Prime Minister at the time, David Cameron. And they simply asked him, what about people who would go and fight against the Islamic State? And he said in one line, I should say, they're very different from the terrorists that are going out and hurting people in Syria. And I saw that almost not as a green light necessarily, but I knew that people at home wouldn't fundamentally disagree with what I was doing.
So now that ISIS has surrendered its territory in most of Syria, would you say most of those British volunteers you've worked and fought with, do they want to return?
I think many do, but many more will choose to stay and try and not just to fight, but to rebuild the communities that have been destroyed. We have to invest in the country if we want to make people feel liberated, make people feel like they've got a future in the country. So my next step now is to start raising money, start campaigning for Britain and America to invest in the country.
That is assuming you get through customs, because many British citizens have gone to Syria to fight either with ISIS or with their opponents like the Kurds. They return to the UK and are initially arrested under the Terrorism Act. A lot of them do get out on bail but are left in some legal limbo. Are you worried about what will happen to you?
Yeah, hugely. It's very frustrating that we have such a very vague law when it comes to international volunteers going out and fighting abroad. It's very clear in the sense that we can't go abroad and fight against Britain's allies or interfere with British interests abroad. But at the same time, I've gone, and many other people have gone, to fight against terrorists, brutal terrorists that are enemies of the UK and hurting us both at home and abroad. And the real trouble in the UK is that the Home Office has almost wiped its hands of all this and simply said to the local police forces and counterterrorism officials, look, it's up to you whether you want to arrest these people. You arrest them under suspicion of terrorism, which is a very broad term, and it's up to you to try and seek a prosecution. Some people have been arrested. None of them have been successfully prosecuted.
I mean, put yourself in the British government's shoes, though. I mean, if they know someone went to Syria, how can they determine if they went to fight with ISIS or with other forces there, like the YPG, as you did?
Well, a lot of us have been very open and honest online and on our social media. You're absolutely right. It's up to the people investigating what course of action to take. One thing that's important is that existing legislation in the UK is actually good enough, because we're stopped under the suspicion of terrorism, but we're only questioned under Section 7, which is basically not an arrest. It's just we've got to explain ourselves, which is a perfect opportunity for us to do just that, to tell them exactly who we are, what we've done, hand over our phones and other electronic devices, and put their minds at ease. There's no need to make the arrest, particularly when we're so keen to offer up who we are and what we're doing.
Maser, good luck getting back to the UK. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Bye-bye now. Bye.
That was Maser Gifford. He's a British citizen who went to join Kurdish rebels in the fight against ISIS. We reached him in Syria, near the border with Iraq. Historians, not to mention conspiracy theorists, are excited today. That's because the National Archives is releasing the final batch of classified documents related to the Kennedy assassination. Right now, we're going to look at another presidential assassination that's also shrouded in mystery. This one, the president of Burkina Faso in West Africa, Thomas Sankara. 30 years ago this month, I was living in the capital, Ouagadougou, had just moved there, and then this happened.
Coup d'état. La nouvelle a été confirmée ce matin à Ouagadougou. Thomas Sankara, ancien chef d'état.
Sankara killed by his second in command on October 15th, 1987. That was the bulletin on the BBC's French for Africa broadcast. I don't want to talk about his killing, but about his legacy, since he's still not that well known. Sankara had come into power 4 years earlier in a bloodless coup. He changed the colonial name of his country, Upper Volta, to Burkina Faso, literally the land of people of integrity. He was a young man, 37, when he died. 3 years earlier, 1984, President Sankara went to New York City.
Notre Maison Blanche se trouve dans le Harlem Noir.
That's what I said, and I will repeat myself. My White House is in the Black Harlem.
This was at a gathering in Harlem. He arrived in his camouflage fatigues and red beret and told a receptive crowd of several hundred that this was his White House.
Nous devons être fiers d'être noirs.
You have to be proud to be black.
It wasn't just sloganeering. Sankara believed deeply in a pan-Africanism that reached across the diaspora, and for him that included Harlem.
Les frères sont en Afrique du Sud.
Our brothers in Southern Africa.
Ils doivent être libérés.
They must be free.
Sankara was fighting apartheid, but also the wider legacy of colonialism and imperialism. That rally was punctuated by Sankara's trademark call and response.
L'impérialisme!
Imperialism. Down with it, answered the crowd.
C'est un homme un peu dérangeant, président Sankara.
That's French President François Mitterrand in 1986 at a state dinner in Burkina Faso. He was saying Sankara is an unsettling man, and Mitterrand was saying that to Sankara's face. Moments earlier, Sankara had publicly scolded Mitterrand for allowing the leader of apartheid South Africa to visit France. It took Mitterrand aback, so when Sankara was done, Mitterrand put away his prepared remarks and stood up.
Il pose des questions, quoi.
Sankara asks questions.
Avec lui, il n'est pas facile de dormir en paix.
With him, said Mitterrand, it's not easy to sleep peacefully. So why did Sankara keep people like Mitterrand up at night? He was brash and challenged the historic order.
Critics were saying he is a dictator. Of course, that was not democracy, we have to say. But people think about him as a hero.
That's architect Francis Quéré. We'll hear more from him in a moment. But Sankara the hero, that is still very much the case for many Africans, not just Burkinabe. When Sankara was president, a giant billboard dominated the main plaza in Ouagadougou. It read, "Consume what we produce, produce what we consume." Sankara rejected the post-colonial grip on Burkina and didn't want to depend on France for anything. But Sankara also divided a lot of his own fellow Burkinabe with his notion that a truly independent country requires hard work. His ideas like obligatory exercise for civil servants 2 days a week and making all government employees, even ministers, fly economy class. But the bloody coup that came 30 years ago this month was still a shock. Women were especially upset because Sankara was like no African leader they had ever encountered. He publicly opposed female genital mutilation before most of us in the West had heard about it. He put unprecedented numbers of women in cabinet positions. Suddenly, women felt free to call out domestic violence, holding rallies.
Les maris qui battent les femmes. Les maris qui torturent.
Targeting husbands who beat their wives.
La patrouille, la mort.
Allô, bonjour.
Allô, bonjour.
Mariam?
Oui.
I called up Thomas Sankara's widow, Mariam. She now lives in Montpellier in southern France. I wanted to know how real his feminism was at home, back in Ouagadougou.
Il respectait la femme, donc moi il me respectait.
He respected women, she told me, so he respected me. At home, we shared in the decision-making. And then she laughed. Because he was egalitarian, she said, is why I accepted his hand in marriage. In Montpellier, where Mariam Sankara lives, there's a small street named after Thomas Sankara. It's young French activists there who made that happen, she told me. It's also young activists in Africa who keep Sankara's memory and mission alive.
La jeunesse actuelle, elle, quand elle a ses...
The youth today in Burkina Faso and in other parts of Africa, she says, they want to solve problems, solve them immediately. Problems around justice and corruption, and always remembering Sankara's message about not submitting to big political powers.
À la volonté des grandes puissances.
But Mariam says just remembering her late husband's reputation as egalitarian is not enough.
Alors que c'est vrai que cette lutte-là est bien, c'est bon.
We must hope, she says, that the youth not only admire Sankara, but that they are also examples of his vision.
I am like many, many young people in Africa who was inspired by this leader who was trying to create something for the people.
That's Francis Kéré, the Burkina Bay architect we met earlier.
When he was killed, I was already in Germany and I was 22 years old.
Kéré went to Germany to study architecture. He now heads up his own design firm in Berlin. He's taught studios at Harvard and won awards. And his success has grown up around an approach that begins with local materials. That comes from Thomas Sankara.
Sankara was the very first leader that tried to deal with architecture. And you know what he did? With clay, integrating local material to create housing.
Clay bricks, a traditional building material, with some modern updates. Kéré has returned to his home country numerous times to build schools, nurseries, activity centers, even the new Parliament House, using those clay bricks. When Sankara was a champion of this kind of improved construction, he encountered resistance for a very simple reason.
Let's be honest and say modernity is quite very attractive, you know. But the thing is, Sankara really wanted to push the people, be really, really independent, you know. And he was hoping there will be a chance, but some people consider him being an enemy.
I had moved to Burkina Faso to work as a freelance journalist and had been there for about a month when Sankara was killed. It was a mystery, and it's never been fully investigated. All that is known for sure is that Sankara and 12 of his associates were ambushed during an afternoon meeting on a Thursday. For several days, Burkina's state radio played military music, sometimes Soviet, sometimes French. And then on Sunday afternoon, someone at the station played the first non-military music I heard. It was this song by Dionne Warwick. I doubt anyone in the new government was listening that closely or would have gotten it if there was something to get. But a lot of hearts in Burkina Faso were broken when Sankara was killed. I wonder sometimes what would have happened if he had lived longer. Would he have had a chance to build on his promises? Or would he have disappointed, like so many leaders in Africa, with big dreams? Parents want the best for their kids. That's pretty much universal. And at the top of the list is almost always education. But this next story takes getting your kid into the right school to a whole new level. Writer Lenora Chu, who's from Texas, moved to Shanghai with her husband. And when their son turned 3, they started looking for a kindergarten.
You know, there's always a school when you move to a new community, the one that everyone talks about. You hear the infrastructure is great. It's beautiful. The teachers are well paid. The wait list is a mile long. And this was that school. It was a school that everyone wanted to get into. And it was just 2 blocks down the street.
But Chu says securing a place in this elite school wasn't going to be easy.
Now, it only enrolls Chinese nationals, except that that year they had committed to taking a few foreigners. and we wanted to give it a shot. So we walked by the school. We saw the infrastructure. You know, we tried to get a meeting with the principal. We were denied several times. Finally, one of our calls went through and we were invited for an interview. So the whole family went. We dressed to the nines. And after that interview, we did manage to get a spot. So our son was 3 years old when he started there. It is a state-run kindergarten, enrolling ages 3 to 6. And then you go into primary school. So the first week of school, my son comes home and he tells me that his teacher forced him to do something he didn't want to do, which was to eat eggs. She essentially lined up all the 30 children at their lunch tables and pushed eggs into their mouths until they swallowed. So I run off to school and I confront the teacher and I say, you know, in America, we don't use methods of force. And her reaction was to scold me for challenging her authority in front of a child. So immediately we had this conflict, and that really raised questions in my mind. If you look at international media headlines, around those years, Shanghai teenagers were number one in the world in math, reading, and science. You know, these were apparently the world's best students. But here on the ground, I had this very different story of children being taught to sit for long periods of time, children being told to eat things they didn't want to eat. You know, this idea of authoritarianism in the classroom was very interesting to me and also a little bit troubling. I began to notice little behaviors in my son. He was dragging his feet in the morning. He began to whine that he hated school. And one time I also saw him reenacting a role play in which he imitated a teacher threatening a classroom of children, saying, if you don't nap, I will call the police to take you away. You know, immediately this raised some anxieties in my head. What was happening in that classroom? You know, teacher knows best in China, but I knew that, but I didn't know exactly what it would look like. And here was my son going through all these sort of adjustments to teacher Chen, this very fierce authoritarian teacher. And I was very concerned about it. In the book, I write that I was sometimes incapacitated by doubt and fear. And that was true, you know. But at the same time, I began to see my son picking up positive signals around education. He sort of went through this transformation. You know, he began to say hello to the teachers. He walked in through the door. He began packing his own backpack. You know, he began to pick up this idea that hard work pays off in the classroom with simple things such as counting exercises. And, you know, I'm American, but I was born to Chinese immigrants and raised in the U.S. And I went to public schools, but then I came home to my very strict Chinese parents. And there was some value to the way that they raised me, the belief in hard work, the belief that you respect your teacher, that learning math and science is important in the early years. And here I had my son in the school where he was picking up all of that signaling without really me having to do anything. You know, on the one hand, I had a lot of anxiety, but as I began to calm down and sort of watch what was going on around the school, I began to realize that they did certain things for a reason.
Shanghai-based journalist Lenora Chu there. She's the author of Little Soldiers, An American Boy, A Chinese School, and The Global Race to Achieve. All right, let's end the show in style. Tomorrow, an exhibit opens in London called My Name is Prince. Yep, the purple one is being remembered with a special retrospective at the O2 Arena. The show features all kinds of Prince artifacts, including some of the trademark outfits he wore on stage. Prince's sister, Taika Nelson, is in London for the opening. My BBC colleague Michelle Hussein asked her which outfits on display are most quintessentially Prince.
The shirt from the opening night at the O2 in 2007, I think that's a unique item. And then I've always loved the chain hat from My Name is Prince with the chains on it. When I saw that, you know, I'm like, I want one. And then when I actually saw it and how heavy those chains were, I said, I don't want one.
How close were the two of you?
We were very close. We were kind of inseparable from birth, or my birth, because I'm younger, until he passed.
You were his full sister. He has, yes. He had other half-siblings as well. How much of the look was very much from him that he had created, or did he have people who fed into the image that he created?
He normally would tell them what he wanted, and then they'd bring it back and say, is this what you were looking for? If it's not, he'd go, no, cover this up, do that, put that in there. So my mother was a clothes designer. So the fact that we both designed clothes, obviously he went on to design clothes that people saw. He designed Sheila E.'s outfit and some of the band members' outfits.
Now, I mean, I can imagine this has been a very difficult 18 months for you, and there have been some significant family disagreements in that time as well. Will we see the release of music that he recorded but which was not released in his lifetime?
Oh, definitely. Prince always wanted his music to be heard from around the world. Him and Daddy, they always wanted their music out there. I mean, Prince himself has even said, you know, maybe he won't release it, but someone will.
Prince's sister Tyka Nelson speaking there with the BBC's Michelle Hussein. I don't know what's going to happen ultimately with Prince's unreleased music, but I do know this. Prince's art made a deep impact on fans all over the globe, and many of those fans are fellow musicians who continue to pay tribute to Prince. This is a song called Adunya by Mdou Mokhtar. He's a singer, songwriter, and electric guitar whiz from Niger. And, yeah, he's an actor too. Mokhtar starred in a 2015 film called Akunak Tedela Taha Tazugai. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Anyway, it's Mokhtar's tribute to Purple Rain, except in the Tamashek language, there really isn't a word for purple, so the title translates as Rain, the Color of Blue, but with a little red in it. Yep, the songs on the whole album are just as poetic. With a Tuareg twist, and yeah, that is a big twist. Where else but the world? From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us.
PRI, Public Radio International.